heard the famous saying, history repeats itself? You see a historical event play out and you think, this has happened before. We've seen this before. And Mark Twain added his own spin to this. He famously said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And I really like that. It makes me think of the movie The West Side Story. Who's seen The West Side Story? Okay, some people. So I watched an old version of this movie when I was a kid growing up with my aunt and cousins, and I loved the music and the dancing, and there's cool costumes. And so if you don't know, West Side Story is a tragic love story between Tony and Maria in New York City in the 1950s, but Tony and Maria come from families who are rivals. Tony being from a gang called the Jets, and Maria's brother is the leader of the opposing gang called the Sharks. So if you aren't familiar with the story, or if you haven't picked up on it yet, this story is based on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Now, I'm not trying to say spoiler alert for a story that's pretty famous, but I'm just going to go ahead and say that it does not end well for Romeo and Juliet, which also means it does not end well for Tony and Maria. They remade this movie, The West Side Story, in 2021, and I had two friends who were going to see it. I'm not going to name them, but they may or may not be in this room. And I wasn't able to make it, so I couldn't go see the movie with them. And I said, oh, but I love The West Side Story. You guys are going to love it. And I know that it's based on Romeo and Juliet, and I assumed that they also knew that. So it wasn't until I got some frantic texts later that said, this movie is terrible. We did not know that it ended like this. And I said, well, don't you know it's based on Romeo and Juliet? That's the dead giveaway. And they said, no, we were very blindsided. And it definitely would have been helpful to know that this is going to be a tragic love story and it doesn't end well. You kind of need to know that before you go into a story, right? So our passage tonight is actually the same situation. We're going to read it and we're going to realize patterns. We're going to hear echoes of things and we're going to think, I think I've read this before. And you would be correct. A very familiar story is going to be playing in the background, which means that we do know where this story is headed. Our story is about two women. One, a woman who was waiting on the Lord to fulfill a promise, but instead of continuing to trust in his faithfulness and on his timing, she took matters into her own hands at the expense of another woman. And the second woman, who was abused and mistreated, we're going to see about this story, and we're going to see about a God who sees the brokenness, he steps into the mess, and he offers redemption and hope. So we've been reading through the book of Genesis, and where we're at is we know that God has told Abram, who will become Abraham, I will probably use, all their names are going to change actually like really soon, but I'll probably use Abram, Sarah, his wife, Sarai, as her before her name changes. So if you hear me use those interchangeably, that's who we're talking about. But we know that God told Abram, you're my guy. You are going to get a lot of descendants, and I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to give you land, and I'm going to actually develop this blessing through your seed, through your offspring. And then you are going to be a blessing to all of these other nations. So our story picks up with Abram and Sarai. They're still waiting on that promised child. We will see Sarai's attempts to take matters into her own hands at the expense of her Egyptian slave named Hagar. To lay some foundation before we read our text, we know that Abram had gone to Egypt at one point. We read about that back in Genesis 12. Because he traveled there to Egypt because there was a famine. And so if you remember when he was in Egypt, some funny business went down with his wife. He told Sarai, you are so beautiful. And I'm actually afraid that the Egyptians are going to see you and they're going to see how beautiful you are and then they're going to kill me because they want you. They're going to see you and desire you and try and take you. So let's just say that you're my sister and so that way I will be treated well. And that my life will be spared. Great idea, Abram. This is one of your best. This is definitely going to work out. So sure enough, Pharaoh thought that she was beautiful, brought her into his palace. And verse 16 says that Abram was treated well. He acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, camels, and male and female servants. So it is likely at this moment is when Abram and Sarai acquired Hagar as a servant. So it's interesting already that the foundation of this story, Hagar and Abram and Sarai's home, is one of deception. Abram lied to try and save himself out of that deception, and from that deception, a woman was acquired. So the foundation has just already been set for Hagar's treatment. So let's read Genesis 16, and we'll start with verses 1 and 2. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go, sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Sarai was barren. She had no children. Sarai was barren from even before God promised Abram and made a covenant with him and promised a child. And then after the promise, still, when Abram, knowing that Abram will father a great nation and be a blessing to others, Sarai still doesn't have a child. Abram has doubted God. He's like, "I don't have a kid yet. You said I was going to have a kid. And so actually, I'm starting to think that my heir is going to have to come through a servant in my house." And right before this story, God actually reemphasized, "No, the heir is going to come from the son who is your own flesh and blood between you and Sarai." But we're still here. Sarai still has no child. And she says, "I've had enough. God has promised me a son, so I'm going to make sure we get a son. Abram, go sleep with Hagar. Maybe I can build a family through her." Now, build a family through her, that's kind of a weird way to put that. Build is a strange word. And normally it refers to, obviously, buildings or structures. And so in the narrative of Genesis, if we're just going to kind of try and take this in context, things that have been built already, Tower of Babylon in Genesis 11, or Cain's son Enoch built a city. Like, okay, yeah, that makes sense, build. But then there's one other time that that word build was used, and it was actually back in Genesis 2, verse 22. So remember when God made a woman from the rib, or really kind of means like the side of man? That word made, God made, some translations might say he fashioned out of the side of a man, is actually the word for built. So it's the same word that Sarai is using. God built Eve, beautiful creation, but Sarai is trying to build her own family. So this is our first parallel between Eve and Sarai. So Sarai says, "Abram, you should sleep with Hagar." Abram says, "You don't have to tell me twice." So back to verse 2. Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave, Hagar, and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. So already we have a split from the Genesis ideal, which is two we will become one, and now we have a third party. So this already is going against God's design. This in no way is an affirmation for any sort of polygamy. I just want to make that clear. And we'll know that this was a bad thing because bad things are about to happen. But Sarai took and gave to her husband. Took and gave. This sounds like Eve again. In Genesis 3:6, Eve took the fruit and gave some to her husband. Sarai takes Hagar and gives her to her husband. Except this time, Hagar is the object of desire instead of the fruit. She is something that should not have been taken and given. So if this story is anything like Genesis 3, we already know where this story is going. Verse 4, he slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. So Hagar is now in the place that Sarai longed to be. She was elevated from slave girl to matriarch. she's pregnant with Abram's promised child. That's what it appears, or at the very least, she's pregnant with a child that Sarai so badly wanted. So the roles start reversing, where now Hagar, who was treated poorly, who was taken advantage of, abused in Sarai's schemes, is now brought up to her own level of power. So Hagar, in turn, starts treating Sarai poorly. She despises her. She's treating her as unworthy of notice or attention. So it's just worth noting that although what was done to Hagar was sinful and wrong, it does not give Hagar permission to now do wrong against Sarai. Well, then Sarai just blames everything on Abram. Verse 5. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong that I am suffering. Okay? I put my slave in your arms, and now she knows she's pregnant, and she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." Okay, easy does it, Sarai. This is all Abram's fault? Nice try. Not to say that Abram is free of guilt here. I'm sure he was a willing participant, but this was Sarai's scheme. Verse 6. "Your slave is in your hands," Abram said. "Do whatever you think best." So Sarai mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. Abram tries to remove himself from the blame. Blame shifting between a couple? How that couldn't be what Adam and Eve did in the garden, too. Adam saying, "Well, it was Eve who ate the fruit and gave it to me." But Abram says, "It's your deal. You do whatever you think is best." And because Sarai always knows what's best, right? Sarai decides, and then she flips that power struggle back, and she mistreats Hagar, so Hagar flees. So, story number one. A woman who was given a promise, who started to think that God was holding out on her. That maybe he wasn't going to be good on his word. That maybe he forgot about her. That instead she should take matters into her own hands, because she knows better, right? And how do we know that God is going to hold up his end of the deal? I don't blame her, honestly. We don't have visibility into all the inner workings and motivations, but I can relate to her. "Lord, you promised. Why aren't you doing this? This is a good thing. I want what you want. And yet, why am I going through this? Why is this the situation? Why is this the burden that I have to bear?" Sarai is left with a choice. Trust in Yahweh or trust in yourself. Trust that God is who he says that he is. He'll do what he was going to do. He'll save you. He'll rescue you. Or listen to the voice of the serpent. Did God really say that? So the lesson we can learn from Sarai: God's ways are better than our ways. What areas of your life do you fear God is not going to stay true to his word? How are you being tempted to take things into your own hands? Even when it feels like there's no path forward, are you going to trust that he will make a way? Or are you going to make your own path in your own timeline on your own strength? This story reminds me of a story in my own life, which was when I was trying to change jobs, and I really wanted to work for this company called Bible Project. And many of you know, the end of the story ends, I do end up working at Bible Project, which is where I work now. And sometimes I want to say this disclaimer: I don't ever speak for the company. And all the words that I say tonight are my own words. But it was just a dream. It was something that I wanted for so many years. And I just thought, I would love to work for this company. Bible Project makes education resources, videos, classes, animation videos, podcasts, incredible things about the Bible. And we talk about Bible Project a lot here. We quote from them a lot. And so I had this journey of getting this job where many years ago I applied several times to this company, and all the doors kept closing, and I just kept thinking, "Come on, Lord, this is a good thing. This is a good company, and please, can I please have this one thing?" And I just didn't understand. It felt like I got to a place where I was trying to shove like a square peg through a round hole, and kind of came to a point where I was like, okay, Lord, I trust you. I understand. And so I was working a job, and I kind of was thinking, I don't know what I'm doing here. This is a weird, kind of one of those weird jobs, and like, this is what I do to make money, but I'm not thrilled about it. But little did I know, I was learning some skills. And I had no idea that they would be important skills that I would need. And then 2 years later, sure enough, this job opened up at Bible Project where it was the exact skill set that I had been learning the last 2 years. And then I got this job at Bible Project, and I could not believe that I saw before my eyes me trying to write my own story in my own timeline. And the Lord said, just wait. I'm working on it. I actually have something for you. But if you just wait and trust me, it's all going to make so much more sense. It's a story I couldn't ever have written in my own way, in my own timeline. But I'm like so grateful, Lord, I trust you. This, you are who you say that you are. So I get Sarai. I really resonate with this. But our story isn't over. We still have Hagar. So the woman who was taken advantage of, she was not free from her own wrongdoing. She certainly had her own wrongdoing, but she was sinned against. But what happened to her? She flees into the wilderness, and a messenger from the Lord meets her there. Genesis 16:7. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. So the text tells us that it was an angel of the Lord, a divine being with a message. But, you know, Yahweh is kind of unique when a messenger of the Lord comes to people in the Hebrew Bible. Because later we'll also read how the angel of the Lord will speak to her as if it was Yahweh speaking to her, saying, I will do this for you. And then later, Hagar will identify that she met God at a spring in the desert. So we see a duality of how this person is both a messenger of the Lord and the Lord himself. It's outside of our modern practical understanding of the world, but it's not outside of the realm of God's unique character and how he interacts with humans. So Hagar flees on the road to Shur, which is a road towards Egypt. So she's trying to go back home. And God meets her by a spring of water. Now, we're starting to see parallels with Adam and Eve, except this time, instead of paralleling with Sarai, we're paralleling with Hagar. Adam and Eve ran and hid from God. Hagar runs and flees. Adam and Eve were in a garden where a river flowed. But this time, Hagar is in the wilderness where there's no life, no vegetation, no water, but God brings forth water out of the dry land for Hagar. Also, God sought out Adam and Eve in the garden, and an angel of the Lord, or the Lord himself, found Hagar. So you see these parallel themes are still running through. In verse 8, and he said, Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai, she answered. The angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The parallel continues. When God found Adam and Eve in the garden, he asked, where are you? Here he asks Hagar, where are you going? The messenger tells Hagar to go back to her mistress and submit to her. Why? For what purpose? Wasn't she wronged by Sarai? Why couldn't she just go back to Egypt and be free? And I'll be honest, I have no special, unique insight here. I don't know why. From my understanding, it seems like it would be better that she could go on without them. But God's understanding is greater than my understanding. I know that we're not done with Hagar. She'll show up again in Genesis 21. Where we're actually going to find her again in the wilderness. And this time there's a tree and there's another well of water. And so perhaps he just wanted to write more of her story and show us more about his character through her own circumstances. But regardless, God sees Hagar, whose name means immigrant. He sees and hears the cry of the oppressed immigrant in the wilderness, and he blesses her. Verse 10, the angel added, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You shall call him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility towards all of his brothers." The angel of the Lord, this is where you can start to hear, like, it sounds like Yahweh talking himself, is giving her a blessing. "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." Now, I have heard this before. God said those exact words to Abraham. "I will increase your descendants. You will father many nations, and I will bless you. You will have more descendants than the stars in the sky." Now, isn't that interesting? This woman who is desperate and in exile needs rescuing, and her seed will be blessed. Now, don't forget, Hagar is Abram's first son, and God promised that he would bless Abram's descendants. He is doing just that. Ishmael is going to be blessed, but he is not going to be the one through whom Yahweh is going to carry his promised Messiah. The promised snake-crushing seed from Genesis 3 is going to come through Abram and Sarai's child, Isaac. Additionally, Ishmael is not going to have an easy life. He's going to dwell in the wilderness. Verse 12 says he will be a donkey of a man, whatever that means. He's going to be in conflict with everyone, and especially with his brothers. Conflict of brothers, we've seen that in Genesis. Cain and Abel, Noah's sons, now Isaac and Ishmael. The descendants of Ishmael are going to come up against the descendants of Isaac, who become Israel. These nations are going to come against each other a lot more throughout the Hebrew Bible. But God's goal is always that Israel is a blessing to the other nations, including Ishmael's descendants, if they walk in the way of Yahweh. God does not punish Hagar. In fact, he actually goes and finds her in the wilderness to give her that same blessing that Abraham received. And just like Adam and Eve, after they were hiding from God, God renewed their hope and gave them a blessing. He promised Eve a descendant, and he brings similar hope to Hagar through the abundance of Ishmael's descendants. At the end of our story, verse 13, she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." And then there's just like a little author note at the end. That's why they call the well Be'er Lahai Roi. I don't know if I said that right. It's still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. Hagar's response is, "Lord, you have seen me." He sees her story. He sees her heartache. He sees her pain. He sees the wrong done to her. He sees the wrong that she has done as well. Also, the spring that she comes across in the desert, that Hebrew word is ayin, and it can be translated spring or water, and it can also be translated eye or sight. So God sees her at a fountain, which is a play on words, because that word fountain, spring, can also mean eye or sight. Come on. The Bible is so cool, you guys. Just like Eve saw that the fruit was desirable and she ate of it, and the serpent told her, "If you eat of it, your eyes will be opened." But then on the flip side, Hagar is not in the garden. She's in the wilderness. She's brought into a garden of sorts because there's a spring of water where she's actually the one whose eyes are opened and she sees God and God sees her. That's pretty incredible. Hagar was seen in a way that no one had seen her before. So the lesson that we can learn from Hagar is God sees me. I recently was talking to a friend about something that I was praying through, working through in my life. And I shared that I felt really alone. And it felt like no one else knew what I was going through. And obviously I know I'm not the only one in the world who had experienced this. But kind of in my current season of life, no one could quite relate to me. And no one really knew what it felt like to experience this. And that I felt alone. And while she was not going through the same thing that I was going through, she shared what she was experiencing in her life at the time and said, I've also felt really alone, like no one can relate to what I'm going through either. And I couldn't believe it. We were both going through our own separate circumstances, but feeling the same way, isolated and feeling unseen. It was like the serpent was whispering in our ear, does God really care about you? You're all alone, and no one knows what you're going through. God sees me. God sees you. Now, why do I keep pointing out the fact that this story is mapped onto Genesis 3 with Eve? Well, first of all, the biblical authors actually wanted us to see these connections. Through repeated words and ideas, they wanted us to read Genesis 16 and have an echo of this other story in the background. But just like the West Side Story and Romeo and Juliet, we can see the similarities when we look at these stories next to each other. We can meditate on this passage and hold it up to a light, like a diamond, with Genesis 3 in the background, and we see things we didn't see before. And the light hits it differently when we turn it in different directions. And Genesis 16 starts to make more sense, but also Genesis 3 starts to make more sense. These patterns repeat in Scripture, and each time the character is a little different, the story gets a little more detail or a little different detail than the one before it, and then we hold it up to the light again, and we see all of these stories in a new way. For example, I don't know about you, but I've never found myself as the first created human before in a garden where I'm approached by a talking snake who tries to get me to doubt God. Anyone else experienced that before? Right, so at a glance, Genesis 3 feels like an incredibly unrelatable story and more just like a foundational story. And perhaps you've read it and it has sunk beautifully into your heart in a unique way, but perhaps it's also just a story that you've read and moved past. But I would guess there's at least one couple in here who has struggled with infertility. Those who have longed for a child and thought, why don't we get a child? Why did they get a child? Aren't we faithful enough? Haven't we been good enough, or at least more good than bad? Don't we deserve this? Why are we the ones that have to go through this? You're faced with a choice to trust God and his timing or try and make your own path. You might not have a servant that you can impregnate, but you have an opportunity to look at circumstances you've been given and choose how to respond. You can trust that he knows the whole story and has something better down the road or maybe in a right around the corner. And you can trust that he knows more than you know. And can you even imagine a world where waiting for something is actually what's better for you? That it might seem like right now what's best is this thing that you really want. But what if it's worse if you were to get that thing right now? You can trust him or you can decide God is not good. Otherwise, he would not have let this happen. You can choose to move forward on your own without his regard. But it did not work for Eve, and it did not work for Sarai. It only led to more hurt at her own expense and at the expense of Hagar. And then there's Hagar. You might not be an Egyptian slave, but I bet there's at least one person in the room who has been abused, who has been taken advantage of, who has had wrong done to them, who, very understandably so, reacted to their circumstances poorly, who has found themselves in the wilderness desperate for the relief of what your soul truly needs, which is living water. And crazy enough, there's going to be a story where Jesus himself will meet a woman at a well, and he knows details about her life that she was ashamed of. But he says, I am the living water. So if you're there right now, in a desert, wilderness, in desperate need, can I tell you some good news? God sees you. He has not forgotten about you. In fact, there is nowhere you can go to escape him. It's just like Psalm 139 says, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I hide from your presence? Even in the wilderness, when I feel like I have no hope, even there. The way of Yahweh is not always easy, but it is the way to true life. Without it, we are left to our own devices, choosing our own way, hurting one another, or we're left in the wilderness to die with no living water. He offers us a different way, and all we have to do is decide to trust him. Let's pray. Father, we humbly submit ourselves and we surrender all that we are trying to grin and bear our way through. The circumstances in our life that we hold so tightly with closed fists, Father, help us release them to you. At the very least, help us open our hands. We might not be strong enough to fully give it to you, but we might at least say, I believe, but help my unbelief. So, Father, would your spirit comfort us in our times of trouble? Rescue us in our times of doubt? Would your truth become more clear than the deceit of the world? May we hear the serpent's voice and say, that is not the voice of my good shepherd. That is the way that leads to death and destruction. But I know that Jesus came to give life and give it abundantly. So may we have the faith to trust your goodness, to walk in your way, because it is the only way of life. Amen.